This is Coffee Number 5. I'm your host, Lara Schmoisman.
Are you ready to get some PR? Well, sign up for free and get my template today.
Welcome back to Coffee Number 5. I always thinking about how my world changed. When I was a teenager, I didn't have a cell phone. Cell phones then was only like I have certain minutes and I can only use it. Then emails. Then we have the IQC and I start communicating with my family. And then we were able to add video. And oh my God, the world changed. And now from our phones, we can talk to whoever, whenever. And you know what? You don't even have to pay extra for that. So this world grew up so much in this technology era, but also modify our society. Today, I have here Rahaf Harpoch. Did I say it right or not?
Rahaf Harpoch.
Okay, great. Welcome. I'm so used that everyone misspell my name that I guess that it's okay that happens. So thank you so much. For being here today. I'm super excited. So the first thing I want to do is, can you introduce yourself? Because you did so much in your life that I feel like I'm not going to be doing justice.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I am a researcher. I'm a digital anthropologist. I'm an author. I'm a professor. I generally focus on the intersections of technology, culture, and leadership, or whether that's, you know, branding, or whether that's, retaining people, or whether that's marketing. It's very much about how are the technology tools that we're using, how are they building community, building identity, building relationships, and what are the emerging new markets that we should be looking into. And I do that type of research in a lot of different ways. So I write books, I speak at conferences, I teach at one of the business schools here in France, and I do a lot of consulting and executive coaching around those topics as well.
Wow, it's amazing. And I'm sure you're quite busy because technology was changing so much in the last few years and how we use technology more with COVID. And one thing that I noticed is that companies are always trying to be trending and they use technology even when that technology is not ready or we don't have things that they are clear. And I love that you do a proper research with this. And for example, right now I see that it's a trend that NFTs, even fashion industry, are getting into the NFTs. And when we don't have enough data, we don't know enough how to interact with the NFTs.
Yeah, there's kind of two different ways to think about this, right? So the first is when you have things like new social platforms that emerge, or, you know, like you have brands that want to use TikTok or want to use Twitter on social media. And it's really important to not just rush in and to try to really figure out how is this digital space going to help build our community, build our brand. With new technologies like NFTs, I'm a little more forgiving. I think people can have like an experimental approach. Like one of my core philosophies as a researcher is that digital is a contact sport. The best way to learn and grow is to just get in there. Obviously, carefully, thoughtfully, intentionally, but you can't just sit on the sidelines. And so with things like NFTs, I've actually, out of all the different applications that I have seen that make no sense, one of the few applications that does make sense to me is with luxury brands and fashion. You know, there's a lot of adjacencies. Digital collectibles have been popular for years, way before NFTs. The extension of luxury goods into digital spaces, that also tracks with the way people want to show their identity online, want to communicate with their community online. And so when you see somebody having an NFT, like a bored ape NFT that they've paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for, even though I might not do that personally, I can understand the logic and the psychology behind wanting to signal your wealth using technology. It's the same thing as having a luxury handbag or driving an expensive car. From a psychology perspective, I understand that the technology is not exactly the same as an actual physical good, but psychologically, I think it's really interesting. So if you're a luxury brand, using that type of technologies as an experiment to reach out to your most loyal customers, to extend your brand into new spaces, that's cool. Sure, experiment. What I don't like is when brands or companies come out with these like large philosophical statements where they're 100% sure that NFTs are going to be the best thing ever. And it's like, no, nobody knows yet. And so coming out and being all in isn't really my style or my strategy. And so that's where I start to see some tensions, because when you go all in, then strategically, it's in your best interest for that technology to work out. So I find that companies that are so invested, over invested in new products, end up ignoring warning signs, red flags, ignoring ethical issues, ignoring technological limitations, ignoring consumer hesitation, because they just want to be like, see, we were right. And so I think we need to just
we were first.
Yes.
What I found out is that a lot of companies or even smaller brands, they're trying to be everywhere. And when I always talk to my brands and my clients about having their resources, and the resources is their time, their budget, their team, and their knowledge. Knowledge is a huge resource, that if you don't know the knowledge, you don't have the knowledge that your target audience is there. Or, I mean, there are so many platforms. You're going to put an effort of time. You're going to have to hire a team or do it yourself. And it's going to have a cost to do it right. So if we want to do it right, and also you're going to have to put all these resources, and you need to measure if it's going to do it for brand awareness, for return of it, because normally I don't see that return of investment from social media lately.
Mm.
I don't see creating that. And I don't know if it's because we're trying to be everywhere all the time and not selecting, or we are, or it's just, we need to be a little more careful because those platforms don't belong to us. We cannot control the narrative.
I think you've raised two really important points. One is that from a strategic thinking side, a lot of people are always focused on execution and they think strategy is just execution. And to your point, such a big part of developing expertise these days is in developing knowledge, as you said. So setting time aside as a part of strategic planning to learn and to experiment and to educate yourself is often the thing that gets the step that gets the most overlooked when people are in a rush to be on 17 different platforms at once. And the second point that you raised, I think, is essential, especially with what's happening on Twitter right now, which is we have been because of this iteration of the information ecosystem, we are building our homes on rented land, as my good friend Laura Gassner-Odding likes to say. And that means that we're investing digital labor, we're putting our relationships, we're spending all of this time on platforms that we don't own. And at any point in time, just like Twitter, it could get purchased by somebody whose views you might not be aligned with. Or in terms of Instagram or Facebook, they might tweak the algorithm and then suddenly your metrics, your strategy no longer applies. And that's something that I've been really thinking about myself.
Even in TikTok, that still is a gray area if it's not allowed in the US or not. So yeah, I agree 100%. I always say to my clients and my friends, social media is to support your marketing, but you cannot just create your marketing in a borrowed land. Because it's not even renting, it's borrowing. Because they can say, you go away, and they shut down your account. And if you have all your business built in social, what happened? You cannot control the narrative. You can even not control when something happened to your account called customer service many times, because it's a free service for you.
Yeah. And I think there's a bigger question about the exploitation that some of these platforms have just kind of been doing for the last, decades. Exactly. And it's like all of a sudden we all woke up and we said it takes effort to make content. Not only are we putting our labor and our relationships and our brand and our graphics and our captions and our words into social media, we are the products, because then we're putting in all this labor and the result is that data is being analyzed and then is being sold to, who knows where. And so it feels like, I don't know if you feel this, it feels like it's like a social media moment of reckoning where like a lot of people are really questioning the role that social media has in their lives, should have in their lives, will have in their lives in the future.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I see it also. That's why I always say that your home needs to be what you really can control, and it's your website, that you need to use all your supporting tools that today is social media. In the future, who knows what it's going to be, but everything needs to go back to your home, which is a core of your ecosystem. That is what you can control.
Yeah, I think this is why also even like email is still so powerful, like you yeah. have to own your own list, because that's the only way that you can contact the people who are committed to buying what you have to sell.
Absolutely. I love that you go deep into the origins and to understand the behaviors and why we do this. And right now, there's a lot of conversation about that we are a content creator economy. What's your thoughts about that? Because I know that I have conflicting feelings about it.
I mean, that's a great way of putting it. I also have very conflicting feelings about it. Honestly, we are living in this really bizarre world where we're producing a lot of content for free, most of us, and we're consuming a lot of content for free. And from a business perspective, like that shouldn't be the case. Like it does, uh-huh. The business model doesn't really make sense to me. And I think the biggest challenge to me from a creator economy is when you look at the accounts of whether it's TikTok creators or Instagram creators or YouTube creators, what you see is a giant curve where ultimately it's almost like a bell curve where, you know, you'll have like the top maybe 5% generous, if that are making a lot of money. And then you'll have the giant middle that are not really earning enough to live. When you look at, for example, average revenue from a YouTube channel, it's like the average YouTube channel is making at best maybe, you know, tens of dollars a month or maybe a couple hundred bucks a month. The channels that you're seeing that are earning millions of dollars a year, those are statistically like anomalies. They're not the norm. And so go ahead.
And no, that is really affecting our society, because I can see it. I always say everyone knows I have teenager kids or almost adult kids, that there is this fantasy that you can go online, have a YouTube channel, and you don't have to go to college. Why you get yourself in debt is modifying how our society is seeing their future. And that's a huge concern for me.
Yeah, it was one of the top rated, I don't remember the exact percentage, but one of the top desired careers of Gen Z and even the younger generation, Gen Alpha, was to be sort of internet famous or to be an influencer. And I think it's interesting because as the market itself matures, the ways that you can make money become harder and harder to break into, right? Because it's not just the advertising models that are also deeply problematic and fundamentally broken. It's brand sponsorships. It's your own product lines. It's merchandise. And all of these are not without risk. I remember there was a story, I think it was like last year, and it was a fashion influencer who launched a clothing line, and she wasn't even able to sell like 16 t-shirts. It was like she had millions of followers, but those followers did not translate into people purchasing.
Oh, so I see this with my clients all the time. I have clients with 100,000 of followers, but then we see that their revenue doesn't come from social.
Yeah. So this is also a part of the metrics. And then when you think about the social aspect, what we're actually doing is we're rewarding the wrong thing. We reward people that have big followings. So everyone then is motivated about, I want to build a big audience. I want to have as many followers as possible. When from marketing, you know, we should be rewarding engagement. We should be rewarding conversions. We should be rewarding the people that are going to buy your stuff. Even if that's a smaller audience, I would rather have 100 people that were obsessed with what I was doing than 100,000 people where nobody cared and nobody was engaging.
To me, it's always about the theme or what you're doing as a content creator. And I see lately that there are content creators, and I try to say, okay, who are they? I see their feed, but they're trying to sell me so many products. Is someone who is really into motherhood and has knowledge that can help the audience, or just putting content, one kind of content. I'm a firm believer that every content that we put out there, it needs to be informative and educational somehow. Besides being actionable and memorable, but we have to give something with content. Just putting content for putting content is all against of what I study in my life. And my first degree is in screenwriting, my second degree is in production and direction of television. I work in the marketing world, and it's all about putting content that will connect with your audience. And I see content that it doesn't get to anything. So what's happening with the content? What's happening with the intention on the content?
I think that socially, living online has changed the way people think about content. And now it is second nature for every person, whether you are a brand or an individual, to be commenting, capturing, creating. So you have to understand that the information ecosystem isn't just flooded with people who have a purpose. It's also just flooded with people that want to share parts of their lives, because we have built business models and content ecosystems where we reward people to share parts of their lives, and that all becomes integrated into our feeds. And so what ends up happening is that the first generation of influencers came on board because they had expertise, right? They were experts in makeup, or experts in movies, or experts in electronics, or experts in chemistry. And they were using that expertise. They had an expertise that was combined with a platform that gave them access to a one-to-many model. And that was what was so game-changing, was they had the expertise and now they have the amplification. What's happened since then is that you don't have to have expertise anymore. There are influencers who are famous that have no expertise. There are influencers who are famous that have no skill sets. And that's a big shift for people from our generation, or people from the previous generation, because we were always used to, you have something important to say, and that's why I'm listening. And now the model is everyone's talking all the time because everyone's talking all the time. And that's the way that it is.
Oh, and on top of that, you have all the people whispering in your ear, because when you're trying to do something, they're going to tell you, oh, my friend did that, and my friend did this other thing, or is using this platform. And what they don't realize is that what worked for your neighbor doesn't necessarily work for you, because you're different. And you're not going to have exactly the same people following, or you need to find who's your market and what works for you. And I love the example that you just did about the influencer who couldn't sell their line. And from your point of view, or from your experience that you work with incredible brands, how do you find if there's what a brand or an influencer need to do in this case, or entrepreneur that want to come up with a brand? What are the first steps before they go and they create their brand and they produce it?
I mean, for me, I think the thing that has remained consistent through all these iterations of technology is the desire for community. And I think community is a word that is thrown around a lot. Now, community does not mean followers, okay? Community does not equal followers necessarily. You can have a lot of followers.
Thank you for that.
And not Thank have you. A community. And so for me, I mean, if we're going to be very optimistic, and if we're going to say, marketing at the core, if you're a brand that at the core, you believe that you have something that is going to be of service to somebody else, something that's going to help solve a problem, that is fundamentally what all products and services are trying to do. So the natural step actually becomes, in a world where there's so much noise, you have to start by going and finding and building a community of people who are very interested. The twist, and why a lot of marketers get it wrong, is because marketers for the last, 25 years have been used to marketing strategy where they talk and other people watch their ads and other people consume their content. And being a part of community actually involves listening and participating and collaborating and co-owning. And as an example, I would actually tell you that TikTok, I think, was the first social network to really do that properly, because it was the first social network where I saw branded content from companies that wasn't just, here's our message that we've decided behind closed doors, we're pushing it out as usual. They were listening, they were responding to trending sounds, they were responding to community stories, they were engaging with individual users, they were commenting on individual user accounts in a way that was creating this conversation. And that, I think, was a really interesting shift, because Twitter was the first app that gave permission for brands to be less serious.
And generate the conversation.
Yes. So Twitter, it was like the first time that you didn't need like to be so formal in your brand communication. But TikTok was really the first social network that, in a multimedia way, right, allowed people to be playful. I mean, I think about like Duolingo's account. I think about EasyJet's account. I think about Ryanair. I think about the Washington Post. Like, there are brands that are doing really funny, engaging content that you would not expect to be represented in a marketing strategy.
I love that people got a little more casual on Twitter. 100% until now, it really was that place. I love that also we bridge a gift with the journalist thanks to Twitter. There was a conversation and a lot more social listening from their part. And I love what TikTok did to our society. Before, I used to make this joke that it was all about social media was about to say, oh, I'm going for a romantic walk with my husband. I take a picture, and how romantic can be if you're really posting. And also was to show that my grass is greener and my life is perfect. And I love that TikTok deconstruct that feeling of social media was about being a lot more organic and to be real. And if you can see this in the feeds of Instagram and all, even in LinkedIn, everything became a lot more real.
Yeah. I mean, from an algorithmic perspective, what we have to understand why TikTok was so different is because all the social networks that came before TikTok, every single one had a model of engagement that required either a single opt-in or a double opt-in. So a double opt-in is I send you a friend request, you accept the friend request, we're connected as friends. And a single opt-in is I follow your content as a follower and I'm connected to you that way. So all the social graphs were built upon the premise that I had to choose who I follow and that content creators had to build audience. What TikTok did that was so groundbreaking is that they made it possible for people to see content from accounts that you didn't necessarily follow, which meant you weren't just consuming content from people that you knew or celebrities or big brands. It really started to feel like a town square. You were here. The algorithm is so good that it was giving you content from other people who were sort of like you, interested in the things that you were interested in, that were adding relevant content. This is a really big deal. This completely changed the way that we engage with ideas and communities online. And now, because of TikTok, now you see on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram, suggested posts, suggested accounts. But that really started on TikTok. And so that's why I think it created such a disruption in the social discourse space. Because when I go on TikTok, it's like, as you know, there are times when the entire community is talking about something and you get to hear that conversation from people that you might not necessarily be connected with, people who might not have a big audience, people who aren't verified. And it doesn't matter because the views and the algorithm sort of creates this like this ability to have a dialogue that I find doesn't really exist anywhere else right now on the web.
Okay, so we know what's going on with Twitter right now, and I'm not going to get into that. But those users that they were used to tweet, and there are a lot of people living Twitter, people that I follow and I respect for living Twitter too. But what are they going to be able to share that message? Where are they going? If you can see the future, where do you think that is going to happen with this double-sided communication? What platform is?
I don't know. And here's the thing, you can never know because it's never linear and it's always unpredictable. Like, I think something is going to catch people's imaginations, whether it's Mastodon, whether it's Post, whether it's Truth Social, whatever it is. Like, I think we just have to wait and see for that lightning to strike. People have options now, but there hasn't been one that has sort of captured the imagination of everybody. But, you know, on another level, it's like maybe we lived in an era that's also coming to a close. Maybe being connected to everybody all the time in and of itself isn't the best thing for us. So I've been sort of following a few alternatives, but I'm kind of also just waiting to see because the funny thing about it is there's always an element of the unknown, timing, luck, circumstances that will pick.
Honestly, the whole Twitter thing happened so fast that it was unpredictable. We can know that it will happen. But I have to say, there is one more digital movement that I'm very interested in, and this is Discord.
Yes.
I'm fascinated because I see the Z generation and Alpha generation is the only way they communicate now, through Discord.
Yes.
No text messages. No. So what are your thoughts about this and how this, because this is a whole new way of communications. I mean, they don't use WhatsApp, they don't use text, they don't use email. All their communication happen in Discord.
Yeah, and I think Discord is reflective of the rise of these micro communities, because one of the biggest things that we've seen in the social network space are people moving from public facing to private. This is actually very much aligned with Gen Z and how they use social media, which is why apps like Snapchat and Be Real are becoming so popular. The millennials and the Xers, you know, those generations experienced a sort of permanency to social media posts, right? You posted something on your grid and it lived in your grid forever, or lived on your post forever. It wasn't the habit of the user to go and delete it, to change it. It wasn't really until Snapchat came that said, hey, we're going to have content that disappears, that then became, you know, stories, et cetera, et cetera. And even now with Be Real, the whole concept of images and photos that sort of as photos that disappear after a while and that are very closed circuit. So what we're sort of seeing is the pendulum swinging to the other extreme, not extreme, but to the other direction. So from open and permanent, we're now seeing to closed and temporary. There are Discord servers that are invite only, obviously. So there's a lot of micro communities that are being formed where you have to be invited to join. There are a lot of Discord servers that have a 24-hour or 48-hour delete policy, where everything on the server gets deleted every 24 hours or every 48 hours. So what I'm seeing is that we are moving back towards a time of more privacy and of hidden communication. And this doesn't surprise me, because remember, Gen Z and Alpha generation, they're growing up with their parents posting baby pictures about them, posting a lot of stuff about
them. And they hate it.
So does it surprise you that when those kids grow up, they say, no, thanks. I want to be connected with my friends, but I want to have it in a community. And I don't want pictures of me when I was 3 to exist on the internet for years
and years. Also, I have to tell you, and I see this firsthand, my sons have friendship built online, built on not location. Like, we had to grow up and have our friends that they were in our school, in our community. Like my older son, he's very into movies, and he actually even has a podcast with one person in New Jersey and two people in England in different places, and never seen any of them, and they didn't even know how they look like.
Yeah,
These conversations and in even like a venture together.
Yeah, and I think this goes back to the first point that we've talked about for brands, which is ultimately all of these tools, all of social media reflects a fundamental human need that every single person has, which is the need to be connected, the need to be seen, the need to be heard, the need to be recognized, right? And so if that network can help your son have conversations where he can share his love of movies with people that make him feel seen and heard, that make him feel like he's a part of something, right? Belonging, connection, validation, that's amazing. The thing that we should also mention, because we haven't really talked about it, is that for every single positive that we've mentioned, there is an equal and opposing negative that has been mentioned. And those are things like radicalization on groups, even Discord, you know, people that are sharing fake news or people that are sharing bigotry or hatred. And I think that we should just mention that a little bit as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. These sense of communities, they are communities that they are very productive and very healthy, because it's a place to belong. And as a kid who was, who you don't fit in, you know, your local community, or a teenager, it's fun and actually it's positive to be able to engage. But also we need to be aware of all the bad things that can happen. And for me, it was very hard to try to explain my kids from a very early age and how to be safe online and how to connect with people. And like, we have communities for good. We have communities that they are not that healthy. And there is So we really need to talk about this is a conversation that should exist, and we need to be careful in what places we are really getting on. And the message that we're getting is like just seeing one side of the story many times.
And from a brand perspective, I would say that what's happening with this radicalization and with this increased discourse is that the age of like business neutrality is over. In the sense that I think companies and employees expect brands to take sides, and they expect brands to, whether it was the war in Ukraine, whether it's the environment, whether it's, you know, social justice movements,
the
like
Black Lives Matter. West, situation that just happened.
Yes.
How do you feel about this? Because we're forcing brands to make business decisions because of social issues.
I mean, I think it's good. I think that for too long, businesses have just been focused on profits and revenues and not the impact on the community. And I think if we can use our collective power and our collective voice to minimize harm and to help people and to make the world a bit safer and fairer and more equitable and more sustainable, then I'm all for it.
I agree with you 100%. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here in Coffee Number 5. It was a pleasure having coffee with you, and we will be in touch. And I know that we are going to be hearing a lot from you and with this ever-changing world.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being in Coffee Number 5 with me today. As always, it's a pleasure to have you there. And remember to follow me in all social networks so you know what's coming up. And also subscribe to my email list. And go to larashmoisman.com and you can get all my emails with all my next podcasts and who knows what else. So see you next week with more Coffee Number 5.
Find everything you need at larashmoisman.com or in the episode notes right below. Don't forget to subscribe.
It was so good to have you here today. See you next time. Catch you on the flip side. Ciao, ciao.